KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, and in a special edition, the 100th episode of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina. As I mentioned up front, and I do want to make note of this, in May 2006, when I was a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society, I came upon the idea of perhaps doing a radio show that would talk about technology and internet issues with a heavy focus on intellectual property law. I thought, this would be something that would be fun. I enjoyed radio. It was something I did in high school, something I did a little bit of in college, and I was looking for a way to get back into it. So I emailed the program director at KZSU at that time and said, would you be interested in the show? And a few weeks later, we were off and running. And it's very personally rewarding and humbling to me as well that the show has persisted. And so over 3 years later, we're now recording show number 100. I did want to start the show off by thanking all of you for listening over the last several years. I hope you found the show educational as well as fun and an enjoyable listen. And of course, I do need to thank as well all of the previous wonderful guests that I've had on the show have taken their time and taken the effort to be on the show and to educate our listeners. And of course, I also need to thank everyone at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford who has supported the show, as well as my friends at KZSU FM Stanford, who not only when I was at Stanford, but also since I've been at Stanford, helped make the show what it is by getting it on the air and supporting the show thoroughly. So thank you to everyone for being supportive of the show. And in that way, I intend to celebrate the 100th show of Hearsay Culture. I'm very excited today to have on the show Bill Patry. Bill Patry is the author of the new book, Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars, which has been published by Oxford University Press. Bill is certainly someone who, for anyone who follows copyright or even recent technology issues, should be familiar with. Bill is currently the senior copyright counsel at Google Incorporated. He previously served as copyright counsel to the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary, a policy planning advisor to the Register of Copyrights. He was a law professor. He was also an attorney in private practice. He had a very popular blog for several years covering copyright issues. He's written an 8-volume treatise on copyright. He's written numerous other articles in this area. So he is truly one of the nation's experts in copyright law. And I'm very excited and honored to have him on the show, especially as, again, it's the 100th show. We're going to be focusing on his new book. And I should say up front that we are not going to be discussing the Google book search settlement issues, because that is ongoing. And so that's not something that Bill can discuss publicly, and so we will not be focusing on those issues. But we will be focusing on his book, which focuses directly, as the title suggests, on the state of play in the copyright battles that exist. Should we have strong copyright? Should we have copyright that respects speech more? Should we have weaker copyright? What should be going on? And in Bill's book, he examines a number of issues, but the two that we're going to be focusing on heavily today are how we view copyright as property, and also the language, the metaphors that are used in this battle that often define the debate. We think often of perception as being reality. And in many ways, in the copyright battles, what Bill is suggesting is that perception has become the de facto reality, but perhaps it should not be that way. Bill's book, again, covers a wide variety of issues. It brings up to date, I think, the writing of previous authors who have focused in this area, and gives us a good state of play of the battle from someone who has been in the thick of it for several decades and who currently is dealing with it in connection with his position at Google. I should also mention, as part of disclosure, that Google and the Center for Internet Society have had relationships and have worked together in the past. I, of course, am asking these questions in the context of a journalist, but I did want to make that caveat as well. So, with that somewhat longer introduction, Bill, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Bill, let's start off with a bit more about your background. And while your background perhaps is well known to many, perhaps I'll ask this question. How did you personally become interested in copyright law?
Well, I'm in Northern California. I grew up in Marin County. And in university, my graduate undergraduate degrees were in music, in theory and composition. When I went to law school, which was almost by accident, I took a class in copyright because that was a field that I thought would be the closest to my musical background. And it was a great class. We had a fantastic casebook that was illustrated, and I got quite interested in copyright law. I, as a law student, entered a competition that was sponsored by ASCAP, the Nathan Burton Contest. So I wrote an article about copyright and community property and won the prize, but only because nobody else entered. But I still got the $500. I then sent the paper I had done into the Journal of the Copyright Society in New York City, which they published. And I became friends with Alan Lattman, who was the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the Copyright Society and was really a great figure in copyright. Eventually, he offered to help me get a job as a copyright lawyer, and he did in Washington, D.C. So that's how I came to be a copyright lawyer.
Now, through your experience dealing with copyright law, and it's been both on the practicing side as well as on the scholarly side and on the regulatory and legislative side, is there any particular trend that you've seen over your time dealing with copyright that's reflected in the copyright battles that exist today?
There have been copyright battles from almost the inception of copyright. As a general statutory matter, if you go back to England, which had the first statute as a general matter, 1710 Statute of Anne, that act was passed as part of a regulatory reform of the London bookselling industry, and those battles were quite pitched. Following the passage of the Statute of Anne, there was a second round of battles beginning in about 1731 that was called the Battle of the Booksellers. And that battle lasted, I believe, for over 40 years. So that there have historically been quite a number of contentious debates about copyright, and contentious probably for a number of reasons. One, people can become passionate about issues. When they become passionate, they speak in passionate terms. But the appeal of the arts makes people feel passionate. And when it mixes with commerce, as copyright almost always does, that provides a second ground for, I think, passionate debate. And the third one is that it's a policy legislative issue. And so different groups of people are pressing their positions before lawmakers who are, to some extent, caught in the middle of it. So it's a field that has always engendered very strong feelings. And most recently, I believe that the disputes over peer-to-peer file sharing and the many thousands of lawsuits brought by the Recording Industry Association has certainly captured a great deal of attention. But it's been something that has been a feature of copyright law almost from its inception.
The title of your book, Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars, suggests perhaps, or maybe it doesn't, that there's something different about what's happening today in copyright. So I guess I'm asking you a two-part question, which is, what is the meaning of the phrase moral panics and copyright wars? And then, is the battle as it exists today, in your view, different than the previous battles that you've mentioned?
Yeah, so the title of the book originally was not Moral Panics and the Copyright Laws. It's a title I actually don't particularly like. But the story is this. The original title was Metaphors, Moral Panics and Folk Devils in the Copyright Laws, which I liked a great deal more because I thought it was more colorful and more descriptive about the book itself. My editor at Oxford, Matt Galloway, liked it a lot too. However, since book selling is a business, the business people didn't like it, and they didn't like it because a great number of sales these days are online through booksellers like Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And the search engines for those online booksellers like very short titles. And so I was told that the title of the book had to be shorter because of the functionalities of Amazon, Barnes & Noble search engines. Working for a company that has a pretty good search engine, I, of course, found that to be baffling. But nevertheless, it is what it is, so I had to come up with a different title that would be short, and that if you were doing a search for it, it would come right up on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. So that's how that title evolved. It does, nevertheless, still encapsulate sort of two elements of it, the moral panic part and the copyright part. What it leaves out, of course, is the metaphor part, which was originally the first word in the title. So, and I like that because in looking back at the history of copyright debates, the passions I referred to earlier, you're struck as a reader of any discussion that was contemporaneous of the language that's used in these debates. And you wonder why this particular language is used, and you could just simply chalk it off to people being passionate and using passionate language. But if you see it used over a very long period of time, and you see it used by companies, corporations, people who actually study the manner in which language is processed, then you come to a conclusion that maybe there's something more to it than simply impassioned speech or flowery speech. So I was fortunate enough to live in Washington, D.C. at a time when Jack Valenti was working there. I knew Mr. Valenti. I heard him testify many, many times, and including times when I worked for the House Judiciary Committee. And his language, for anybody who has read it, certainly was very flowerful, very colorful. And many people would either laugh with him, at him, or anywhere in between. There was a tendency, I believe, simply to say, well, that's just Jack. Nobody talks like Jack does, and that's just who he is. It's a part of what makes him charming. If you're on his side or if you're opposed to his side, people might think that he's, you know, less charming, but a showman. And you know, whatever your particular view of him was, there was a tendency simply to make it a personal characteristic of him. And I doubt that was true. Mr. Valenti wrote a book called Speaking with Confidence. He was a great student of speech making. In his book, he describes how, at the age of 10 years old, he became interested in public speaking and gave his first public speech at 10 years old, and how, after that, he's been a very careful student of public speaking. So if you have somebody who's devoted a large amount of his professional career to speech making, to persuading people, he, in Texas, before he went to work for Lyndon Johnson, had been a co-founder of an advertising political relations firm. That was his background. So, you know, he thought a great deal about what he said, and he used his words for particular purposes. So I was interested to figure out how somebody who cared so much about language and about political persuasion used the words he did. The second part of it, however, was also an attempt to figure out how it is that so many times content industries, you know, corporations whose assets include copyright work, opposed the introduction of new technologies. Now, you could take a view, as some on the copyleft side do, that the copyright industries are simply dinosaurs and Luddites, and they have this reflexive Pavlovian reaction against anything that concerns technology. And, you know, there's some basis for that with, you know, attempts to sue. Many new technologies have come along. But I thought the answer was probably more complicated than that. So I tried to figure out what was behind this, and you know, starting from the premise that these are publicly traded companies generally, and that they attempt to maximize their profits. So I thought there was something deeper than that, and so I did studying of those sort of efforts on their part, which technologies they opposed, which ones they embraced, the reasons that they gave for them, and also tried to place them in the larger context of economic actors who are faced with what Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter described as creative destruction, right? The introduction of new technologies, new business models that pose a threat to incumbents. And so my belief ultimately is that, of course, you know, copyright industries aren't Luddites, aren't dinosaurs, that the behavior is actually quite normal for those who are incumbents. So the book attempts to put these two aspects together, the manner in which language is used and why it's used, and why there have been these perpetual battles against new technologies. And those are the problems I attempted to figure out for myself. And I certainly wouldn't say that the book is the end-all, be-all of that. It's really a process. And like any book, it's an attempt to learn rather than an attempt to say, these are the answers. So I hope what the book does is to get people thinking about this, and other people will have different ideas, and other people will be able to improve on it or to see things that I didn't. So that's the goal of the book, is just to think about these issues, not to provide discrete answers for all times.
We're talking with Bill Patry, author of the book Copyright Panics and the Copyright Wars, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. And I should mention that we're recording this show on October 28th, and that Bill is joining us by telephone. Bill, I think it's important, although I mentioned in the introduction that we're not going to discuss the Google book search, and I'm not about to ask you a question about it, but you also address a caveat in the book that I think the listeners should hear, which is the caveat that in writing this book, you're not speaking for Google. And so I don't think anything more needs to be said about it, that it's your personal view, but I do want to ask a purely author question, which is how you found the time to write a book in the midst of everything that's been going on in your field, as well as the kinds of issues that I'm sure you're dealing with at Google. How did you find the time to do it?
Well, I read and write quickly. So that's really the only answer, I guess. But, you know, I read and write one word at a time.
So. Fair enough.
There are people who agonize over writing and who have a lot of problems getting things out because they worry about things constantly. Is this word right? Is that word right? And I polish things too, but I obviously don't have writer's block. And, you know, I sit down like everyone else, and I just do it.
So. Well, and I think that's probably definitely a blessing from a writer's perspective, and it's something that we all strive for. You mentioned your experience with Jack Valenti, and I think it's an interesting topic, and it's one that gets us to this issue of metaphors that you discuss heavily in the book. With respect to these metaphors, some of the ones that you discuss, aside from moral panics, are folk devils, as well as, and I thought it was interesting, how Mr. Valenti and others in effect co-opted the phrase clear and present danger to certain effects. So perhaps you could focus on that. What clear and present danger and how it's been used, and again, whether that's a bad thing from a policy debate perspective.
Right. So you had asked earlier, what is a moral panic?
Exactly.
Right. So a moral panic is a sociological term. It was made popular by a English sociologist, Stanley Cohen, in the 70s. And what he was trying to figure out was why there are these reactions to different groups that are vying with each other, but which society views as an existential threat. He was dealing with mods and rockers. So anybody who has seen the Austin Powers movies has probably seen a bit of this. But there have been moral panics throughout history. And moral panics are simply an exaggerated reaction to people to changes in society. These changes can be brought about by groups that are minority groups, not in the sense of ethnic or racial heritage, but simply who are not a part of the majority, whether it's, you know, for economic reasons or other reasons, or people who have different beliefs, or typically young people. So young people tend to be regarded as a threat for various reasons, you know, that they act differently, they're interested in different things.
Right.
They're young, and sometimes even simply being young is regarded as a threat. So there were concerns about the morality of children for comic books, which go back quite a long ways. There was a comic book code that was created for this, and you know, there was congressional hearings, and people made careers out of how comic books are a threat to children. So, you know, these sort of things are picked up by the media. They became very popular stories. There is an alleged existential threat to society that has to be cured by, you know, extirpating, you know, whoever it is that's causing it. The Salem witch trials, right, McCarthyism, all of these sort of things are exaggerated reactions, and sometimes, of course, exaggeratedly incorrect reactions to things, for which society fears for its future and therefore has to act in certain legal ways to crush them. Now, how this plays out in copyright is that I believe copyright is an economic right. I don't believe it's a moral right or a natural right. It's a utilitarian objective. It's a utilitarian tool for serving valuable public purposes. As an economic right, you would typically try to figure out what's the most effective way to further the economic goal. So if we were to say that our goal is to provide low-cost housing to people, we would do studies and we would figure out the best way in which to provide low-income housing to people. If we were to fund that as a government, we would want to make sure that the money is being well spent. After a certain amount of time, we would probably do studies to see whether or not low-income housing was indeed constructed, whether it accomplished what we wanted it to do, which would be to provide a safe, healthy environment for people. If there was an effort to provide more funding, you know, we would do even more studies. You know, what we would do is we would look at it empirically. We would figure out in an evidence-based way whether or not the government program in question was serving the purpose that we wanted to serve. That has been the exception in copyright law. Mm-hmm. And instead, what happens is that an economic right, which is a valuable economic right, and to call it an economic right is not in any way to diminish its importance, but it's rather an attempt to describe accurately what it is. In copyright law, what we have had are moral panics or use of metaphors like property or thief or trespasser or, you know, digital vampire, all those sort of efforts to take away from the need to have an empirical, evidence-based look at what the proposals are. So clear present and future danger. In 2002, Jack Valenti submitted testimony to Congress in which he called a clear present and future danger, and that invoked a metaphor of clear and present danger that Justice Holmes had used in his 1919 opinion for the Supreme Court in Schenck versus the United States, where Charles Schenck was ultimately sent to jail for his opposition to World War I, in which he advocated that men resist the draft for World War I. His conduct wasn't violent or seditious, and his statements were, you know, hardly, you know, inflammatory. He said things like, do intimidation, assert your rights, If you don't assert your rights, you're helping to deny or disparage rights, which it is the solemn duty of all citizens and residents of the United States to retain. He was nevertheless convicted of that because Justice Holmes of the Supreme Court held that, you know, in times of war, you can't say things that you could say in times of peace. Now, what was going on with Mr. Valente was that after the tragic events of September 11th, and I was working in New York City at that time and had friends who were killed in the attacks on the World Trade Center, 3 months after then, Mr. Valente said, "We're fighting our own terrorist war." And I was really struck by the effort to co-opt what was a great national tragedy, and of course for many people a great personal tragedy, into an economic debate about file sharing. That's sort of the origin of those sort of discussions, and, you know, rather than simply saying that we have an economic right and we're being harmed and this is the way we want to be protected, it's an effort to change the way that things, change the way that you think about things, right? Through the metaphor of war, terrorist war, I think what was going on was an effort to try and get the government mobilized, you know, on behalf of his clients, you know, to exercise the powers of the state and rally the population, as the population had been rallied in World War One and Two, and certainly in the aftermath of September 11th, 2001. And I found that to be quite inappropriate, but unfortunately not unusual.
We are talking with Bill Patry, author of the book Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of ways you could go about it. First, you could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you could go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you consider making a donation and that you continue listening to KZSU and its very varied programming, and that you think about, at least, especially in these tough economic times, the possibility of making any kind of donation to the station. Bill, when we talk about these issues, and I do want to turn a bit, I mean, there's a lot of topics we could discuss, and even in 50 minutes, we touch tip of the iceberg, but I do want to drill down on a couple of other points. You discuss copyright as property, and in the beginning of your chapter 6, and I'm quoting here from page 109, you say, and the title of the chapter is Why Classifying Copyright as Property is Important in the Copyright Wars, and this is a topic, whether intellectual property as a phrase is appropriate, much less copyright. It's something that has been debated for quite a while, as you know, and you've been part of those debates. And I think you raise some interesting points here as well. You say, and this is a quote, "At issue is not whether social relationships are the essence of property. They clearly are. But why are the interests of one social group favored over another?" And you go on to say, "The advantage in regarding copyright as a system of social relationships is that it focuses attention where it belongs, in mediating conflicts within that system," and you've highlighted the word "within," "and not as the property and ownership model and the copyright wars erroneously do, by positing ownership as the natural state of affairs, and by regarding every effort to regulate for the public interest to be a hostile act that must be ferociously fought against as if it were an existential threat." And this definitely ties into your critique of Jack Valenti and other lobbyists for the entertainment industry, but I want to push a bit on this issue of social relationships. As it currently exists, what do you see as the balance in these social relationships? And I guess to answer that question, the prerequisite would be, who are the parties involved in these social relationships?
Yes. So the idea of regarding property as social relationships, I took from a professor at Harvard, Joseph Singer. I went up and spoke to his class. He has a fantastic book about property and sort of the paradoxes of entitlement. And it made a lot of sense to me to regard what most people call as property as social relationships. I mean, if you believe in the social contract, if you believe that we have governments because as a group of people we will fare better than we would in a sort of Hobbesian world where we're each going out for ourselves and it's a zero-sum game where, you know, I have to get what I want because if I don't, somebody else is going to take it away from me. That sort of approach I find to be unhelpful. And so in the debates about copyright, the war part of it, of course, plays into that. The idea that it's them versus us, that they're enemies that have to be vanquished. They're people who aren't like us. And because they're not like us, we have to deal with them as the archetypal other, right? Somebody to be either eliminated or controlled or pacified or somehow made safe for the rest of us. And I don't think that's true. I think that's been a very sad part of too many societies and too many times where people do things to other people that they would never dream of doing if they regarded them as they do themselves and their own family and friends. So in terms of debates about law, it seems particularly inappropriate, and where we have gotten ourselves, I think, is in a very unhealthy state, a them versus us state, you know, a binary way of looking at these things. And very much one of the goals of the book is to break out of that binary approach. And one way to break out of it is to realize that certainly copyright, which deals with speech, which deals with expression, is very much a social construct. It's very much something that has as its heart people connecting to each other. And so with that purpose and with the nature of copyright and copyright works of being, how people relate to each other, the question is, what's the best legal system to develop that's going to permit all of us to engage in the social relations that we want to engage in? And so you would say, probably, concretely, parody and satire are things that we want to encourage, even if that involves using people's work without permission, and even if it involves using it in ways that the authors don't like. Book reviews are another one. You know, we certainly want people to be able to quote from book reviews to make points, and even if the book reviews are unfair or hostile, and I've certainly experienced unfair and hostile book reviews, it's fine for people to use parts of my book, even if they're writing a review that I think is a really terrible review and is horribly unfair and that distorts it. We want that as a society, to encourage those sort of uses. We probably don't want to encourage massive counterfeiting of DVDs or CDs, because that doesn't serve a social purpose. So the idea of thinking about things that way is that it places the debate as one in which we all have a role, and in which we all participate, in which we all have interests that have to be respected and discussed. You know, simply rather than saying, well, I'm a property owner and you're a thief. Mm-hmm. I don't think that gets anybody anywhere. It's simply not true, and it's not helpful. And the efforts to use metaphors, whether the metaphor is like someone is a technology tapeworm, or whether it's simply property, I think is an effort not to advance discussion, but to stop discussion. And so the chapter that you're referring to, chapter 6 and discussions in other chapters, are an attempt to explain why people use that sort of language and that sort of discussion, and to point out why it's not helpful, and to suggest other ways that are helpful. And I think that regarding copyright as a quintessential social animal is a more constructive way to look at what are important issues.
Not only do you discuss hyperbole, but you also level some pretty strong charges regarding the actual data that's been used to support copyright reform. And you discuss the out-and-out fabrication of data that has been perpetuated and become almost part of received wisdom with respect to the impact of piracy. And although that may be true, is it not also the case that there are legitimate concerns here that the hyperbole, and I guess this is my question to you, seeks to mask or amplify? If we assume that that piracy, and using that term advisedly, but the unauthorized reproduction of copyrighted works, let's call it that, from a legal standpoint, exists, why is the hyperbole being used? Is there an underlying motivation, a concern with respect to how copyright law is going to develop or how people are going to receive the information that drive this? Because it seems pretty fair to assume that there's a lot of piracy going on, and so shouldn't that be enough for the argument?
Well, there certainly is unauthorized copying of copyright works that's going on. There is commercial counterfeiting going on, and those have to be stopped. So I'm certainly not claiming, and I point out in the book, that these issues are not like the Goebbels big lie. But moral panics, by definition, are exaggerated reactions to things. It's not to say that there aren't issues that have to be discussed, but those issues have to be discussed accurately. And moral panics and creating folk devils, you know, those people who are engaging in socially undesirable behavior, are really efforts to distort solutions to things and to exaggerate problems. So if there are problems, it makes it very difficult to come up with socially desirable, socially effective solutions when the problem itself is hyped up, you know, wildly beyond what it is. So if you were to take, for example, concerns on university campuses about downloading of movies, you would say there is a problem. There is some amount of downloading of movies on university campuses. How do we deal with the problem? So one necessary step in dealing with the problem is to figure out how big of a problem it is. Right, because if you don't know how big of a problem it is, you don't know the type of steps that you need to take. So in that particular case, the Motion Picture Association had put out a study in which it claimed, I believe it was somewhere around 40% of all the losses in the motion picture industry were attributable to the unauthorized downloading of motion pictures on university campuses through university computer services. Based on that, they got certain members of Congress to send letters to universities threatening them with the cutoff of federal funding for the universities as a whole. That's a very extreme sort of threat to make. But you might say, well, okay, if 40% of the losses of a important domestic industry are occurring, we have to take important steps. We have to take steps that are going to wake people up to the problem and get them to deal with it. It turns out that those numbers were not true at all. They were wildly overstated. And so you would say in that case, well, look, you know, maybe there still is some sort of a problem there. Let's figure out how to deal with it. But cutting off federal funding to universities for something that is, in fact, nowhere near that type of a problem is an inappropriate solution. I think that's one example.
We are talking.
Other examples could be internationally, where if you say there is piracy in the sense that you're using the term commercial counterfeiting going on, and we're losing $12 billion a year from it, and therefore, you know, we're going to slap import duties on products from a particular country coming in. That's a big step to take. Now, if you say that $12 billion is based upon data that simply is puffed up or exaggerated, you might not do that. If you say, for example, that in country X, there is this amount of copying, and it turns out there's really not, or you base it upon a one-to-one displacement, that there is that amount of copying, but the value I'm going to place on it is both the U.S. price and the assumption that every single counterfeited DVD is a loss of a legitimate one, That sort of approach to the data, I think, is inaccurate, and what it leads to is inaccurate solutions. So I'm absolutely all in favor of solutions that deal with real problems, but the data has to be real so that the solutions can be real.
One of the interesting topics, and we have, unfortunately, only about 12 or 13 minutes left, so I'm going to motor through a couple of questions here that I classify as unfair because they require more time to answer fully. But one of the major issues that we've been facing as a society is the retraction of the public domain. And Jamie Boyle has been on the show recently discussing his book in this area. And to a certain extent, Elizabeth Townsend Gard and her work at Tulane with the Durationator also deals with attempting to protect the public domain. Perhaps I'll ask you this question. Are you concerned about the retraction of the public domain? And we've had the recent decision in Golan that actually held that Section 104A of the Copyright Act restored certain works to copyright protection that were in the public domain was found to be unconstitutional, and that case is ongoing. But what's your reaction to this concern about the public domain and perhaps its walling in, as Jamie Boyle has written?
So I'm a big fan of Jamie's, and I visited with him at Duke last week. I have his book, I've read his book, and I think it's a great work of scholarship. I've also seen a demonstration of Elizabeth's Durationator, which I think is a fantastic product, and I encourage everyone to use it. In essence, what they have done at Tulane is magical, and it's magical because it provides people with data to determine when a work is in the public domain, and that's an important step because you don't want to use a work that's still under copyright, but you do want to be able to use a work that's not. And figuring out when it is under copyright, when it isn't, is an incredibly difficult task because it can't be limited to the United States. And even limiting it to the United States, there are a host of particular problems that you would face. So I think the Tulane project is a path-breaking one, and I certainly hope everyone utilizes it. The word I would depart from you on is retracting from the public domain. So for focusing on language, I would use probably different words.
Okay.
The issue of term is a very important one. The Golan case really deals with taking works that were in the public domain and putting them back under copyright. I worked on that legislation when I was with the House Judiciary Committee, so I could talk about the purposes for it if we want to. But the question of term really poses the heart of what an effective copyright law is. And we want to have copyright law that is effective. We don't need copyright law that's strong. We don't need copyright law that's weak. We need only laws, our laws, that are fit for their purpose and, judged by whether in an evidence-based empirical approach they do what they're supposed to do. So you would say that there are certain works that are very expensive to produce and that can be copied at virtually no cost, and that if we don't have protection for those in the form of copyright, then they won't be produced. And I believe that's true. And I believe that we have to protect those works for a certain period of time. If you take a look historically at the duration of copyright, it's been very short. And if you look historically at how much copyright people themselves believe they need, and I think that's an important exercise, not the scope of copyright law that other people believe businesses need, but how long a term of protection that businesses themselves believe they need. You have data on this going from the 1909 Act when we had a renewal requirement. And under that act, you had an original 28-year term of protection. You could get 28 more years if you simply paid the government $10 and filled out a simple two-page form. So most people, I believe, faced with a opportunity to get a 28-year government grant for $10 and filling out a government form would do it, especially if you were a business and you had people who were employed to do just this. So I think most people faced with the idea of getting a 28-year government grant for $10 and filling out a form would do it, and most people would believe that others did do it. But in truth, they didn't. Historically, the renewal rate was only 10%, and this was of a self-selected group that had registered to begin with. So you might say, well, why is it that only 10% of the people were willing to pay $10 to get 28 years more of copyright? The answer is that 28 years originally was quite enough. They didn't need 28 more years. Now, there are some sorts of works that did. Motion pictures had a 74% renewal rate. Books, however, only had a 7% renewal rate. And I would say for my book, the book we're discussing, I would be very surprised if it has any commercial value past 28 years. Mm-hmm. I don't need, you know, life of my my life plus 70 years or 50 years or even my own life probably. I'm not sure if I'm going to live 28 more years. I hope I do. But, you know, we have to calculate, I think, the amount of term that people need to give them the incentives that they need, but no more. And what we have now is a system where we have life of the author plus 70 years for every single work, and for many works that don't need protection at all. And that leads to ineffective laws, and it leads to people not being able to use works that they should be able to use. And that's what people, I think, actually mean by retraction of the public domain. Right? They mean the granting of copyright beyond that which is necessary to create incentives.
We're talking with Bill Patry, author of the book Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars, published by Oxford University Press. I should mention two additional caveats, which is that the Center for Internet Society did handle the Golan case, and I also wanted to remind listeners that Elizabeth Tausengard and one of her students who's working on a project was on the show last week, and you can find that show at hearsayculture.com. In our remaining 5 or 6 minutes that we have, Bill, I do want to ask you two things, and the first one is towards the end of your book, you begin to discuss where we go from here, and it's something that leads into the second question, which is what is your next project? But with regard to the first issue, you seem to recognize, and I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, endorse the view that the business models that are broken, that don't work in the current system, are the problem, as opposed to focusing on changing the law to create those business or to make those business models operational in the current technological climate. And you focus on Japan and South Korea as examples of countries where we see the more advanced use of technology, and therefore, because of that the use of that technology, the ability for the entertainment industry and the content industry generally to benefit from the technology that exists as opposed to tightening the laws. So again, recognizing that we have a limited amount of time, perhaps in 2 or 3 minutes, could you give us some highlights on where you think we could find guidance on these issues from the experience in Japan and South Korea?
So copyright, like many rights, is a negative right. It gives you the right to exclude others. And if you take a property-based approach to things, you would say that one of the most important attributes of having a property right is the right to exclude others. From a business standpoint, however, if your business is selling mass-marketed goods to consumers, what you want to do is not exclude people. What you want to do is to get people to buy your things. And one of the problems that has arisen, I think, for the copyright industry is in their reliance on law to solve what they believe to be their problems, is that they've lost sight of the fact that the only value that they have is value from consumers buying things. If you have material and consumers won't buy it, it has no value. If I think my house is worth $1 million, I try and sell it and someone will not give me $1 million for it, as indeed they wouldn't, then it's not accurate for me to say my house is worth $1 million. So the bottom point on copyright and consumers is that regardless of how strong copyright law ever becomes, the one thing it cannot do is force people to buy things they don't want to buy. You may exclude people from things, but the trick is the opposite. The trick is to figure out how to include people, how to get people to buy things, and copyright can't do that. And so the focus really has to be on getting people to buy things, not excluding them and not suing them. Now, in Japan and South Korea, the focus of the book there is on how new technologies, in the sense of fantastic broadband capabilities, has led to changes in business models that take advantage of those technologies. Right? There's a tremendous temptation to fight technologies that call into question your business model. But if the technology is so amazing, as it is in South Korea and Japan, then I think you can see more clearly what the business opportunities are there. Now, sometimes it's a double-edged sword. So in South Korea, the fantastic broadband capabilities has made it possible for movies to be downloaded easily. And what that has caused some forward-looking companies like Time Warner to do is to do away with the window by which you had staggered releases of DVD being released and then something being released online. You simply can't do that. And so they've been forced to release things online at the same time as they release them on DVD. Also, those technologies have led to the creation of works on cell phones, right? The Japanese cell phone novels, which has also helped creativity. So, the bottom line for me on technologies and business is that if your business is business, your business has to be satisfying consumers and not thwarting them through using copyright law.
We're talking with Bill Patry, author of the book Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Bill, we're just about out of time, but I do want to ask you, and you've advised me that you're working on a new book. So in a minute or two, what is that new book about?
Yeah, so the new book has a tentative title of Blueprint for an Effective Copyright Law. One of the things that I will say has been frustrating to me is that the reaction to the Moral Panics book of some people is, well, but it doesn't tell us concretely how the copyright law should be amended. And that's what I thought you were going to do. It wasn't what I intended to do. It wasn't what I was interested in doing. It wasn't the problem I was trying to solve. But I decided I have to take my own advice, the own advice being that you have to give consumers what it is they want, not what you want to give them. So if people really want a book that says this is the way that the copyright law has to be changed, then that's what I'm going to do. And so I'm going to write that book. I certainly hope that will lead people to read the Moral Panics book for what it attempts to do, which is discuss language and discuss thought processes. But I have listened to consumers, as I tell other people they should do, and so I'm going to write a book about an effective copyright law, what it would look like in concrete terms.
And in that way, not only do you fix your business model, but you live by the adage, the customer is always right.
Exactly. So I have to take my own advice, and I am. I have listened to consumers, and I intend to respond to what it is they say they want.
And that adage has served many businesses very well for quite a long time. Bill Patry, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and for taking the time, and I look forward and I invite you back on the show in advance of your new book to further the discussion.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Bill. I'm looking forward to having a number of interesting guests coming up for the remainder of this quarter as well as into the next quarter. Among them are Kazis Varnelis of Columbia University, who will be on the show discussing his work on networked worlds. Geert Lovink will be on the show, who is a media theorist and critic, and he'll be on the show discussing his work as well. Alex Halavay of Quinnipiac University will be on discussing his book, Search Engine Society. Wendy Chun will be on the show discussing her work involving identity and the internet. We'll also have on we'll have on Bobby Qual will be on the show later in the year and perhaps early next year discussing her new work. Earl Charlton Gillespie will be on discussing his work in copyright. Laura Donardis of Yale University will be on discussing her book involving technology and government. We're also going to have Larry Downs on discussing discussing his book, The Laws of Disruption. Shubha Ghosh will be on discussing his work. And again, this is in no particular order. Professor Frank Pasquale of Seton Hall University and Danielle Citron of the University of Maryland Law School, who will be on discussing their work and their interest in fusion centers. As always, you can listen to the show a number of ways. You can listen live on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. And that's the best way to get the show, because you will get it live and as soon as it airs. After it airs, it is converted into a podcast, and you can get the podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find all of the previous shows and see the upcoming schedule. You can also get the show through the iTunes page that the Center for Internet and Society has, which is simple and can be found simply by typing Center for Internet and Society in the iTunes search engine. You can also get the show through the RSS feed that comes from the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Again, thank you for listening to show number 100 of Hearsay Culture. Again, I want to thank one more time everyone that's been listening to the show, my guests, and my friends at KZSU, including Mark Lawrence, who's the chief engineer there, and Catherine Todd, who was the program director when I started the show, but as well as everyone else who's worked the board over the last few years since I have not been physically at Stanford. Someone has to sit there and make sure that the show goes on the air, and this show would not exist without it. And there are various DJs who do that work, and I thank all of them for it, as well as everyone at the Center for Internet Society. My former colleagues Jennifer Granick and Lauren Gelman, as well as of course Larry Lessig, who were all very early and ardent supporters of the show. And I've had on many of the fellows and people affiliated with CIS over the last 3 years. I look forward to another 100 shows, and I look forward to hearing feedback from you and suggestions and comments by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you so much for joining me today. There is one last, and I debated doing this thanks, but I think it's appropriate. This is almost like an Oscar speech at this point. But I also want to thank someone that I don't mention enough, which is my wife, Heidi, who, as I record this show, in my home studio, as I euphemistically call them, the East Coast studios of KZSU-FM, but it's really my home studio, keeps an eye on our two wonderful sons and really makes sure that everything keeps running so that I can do this show. And I would not be where I am today, and nor would the show exist, but more broadly, I wouldn't be who I am today without the support and love of my wonderful wife. So thank you again for listening to the show. I am done with my speech. I'll now step off stage, and I'll encourage you to stay listening to KZSU for more diverse programming. I will talk to you next week.